collective security and support for frameworks for resolving disputes. So we placed the sign in the window. We participated in the rituals. And we largely avoided calling out the gaps between rhetoric and reality. This bargain no longer works. Let me be direct. We are in the midst of a rupture, not a transition. Over the past two decades, a series of crises in finance, health, energy, and geopolitics have laid bare the risks of extreme global integration. But more recently, great powers have begun using economic integration as weapons. Tariffs as leverage, financial infrastructure as coercion, supply chains as vulnerabilities to be exploited. You cannot live within the lie of mutual benefit through integration when integration becomes the source of your subordination.
That was Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney speaking Tuesday in Davos at the World Economic Forum. President Trump is addressing the World Economic Forum today. Hundreds protested in Davos ahead of President Trump's visit to the WEF, an annual gathering of global business elites. Here are some of their voices.
I think it's really bad, especially what he just did with Venezuela. Like, he literally started a war, and now Switzerland lets him in, and also the WEF just accepts him. I think that's unacceptable.
So we are here because it's a meeting. The WEF is a meeting since 1971. It exists, and it proposes that the world becomes better, that everyone has a better life if those people are meeting. But it's just a meeting of rich people, of politics, and so on.
Lui.
If Trump declares, "I am here for the United States," and he comes to Davos, then he will bring the United States the slightest usefulness that Davos has for the world. And so it is scary.
We're joined now in Davos by Oxfam International's executive director, Amitabh Behar. Oxfam's just released a new report titled "Resisting the Rule of the Rich, Protecting Freedom from Billionaire Power." We'll talk about that in a moment. But first, if you could talk about what's happening on the ground right now. The World Economic Forum, a gathering of the global elite, but now an emergency summit to deal with President Trump threatening to seize Greenland. Can you talk about the significance of this, Amitabh Behar?
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me. I must say that the sound is extremely poor, but at the moment, in fact, now there's a massive queue for attending the Trump session, and you can hear actually protest sounds from outside. So this is really the moment where everybody is gathering. There's, I would say, massive nervousness. The people that I'm talking to, they're extremely concerned about what is the speech going to do. So that's really what's happening at the moment.
Can you respond from your perspective as head of Oxfam International to what it means to turn this into an emergency summit with President Trump threatening to militarily invade Greenland? When you look, for example, in the context of what you deal with at Oxfam International, the global inequality of the world, the amount of money just going into the military to protect Greenland and for the attack, and where else it could go.
So if I'm hearing the question right, you absolutely, I think this is really a critical question, that we as Oxfam work on human rights, on humanitarian support, and at this juncture, the entire multilateral structure seems not just fragile, it's broken. And at this juncture, we need to understand why is this happening. So the very specifics, because I've not heard what's happened in the last few hours, the very specifics are very relevant, yes. But essentially, this is a reflection of the rule of the rich. As our report highlights, we are looking at billionaires actually sitting at $18.3 trillion. And last year they added $2.5 trillion to their kitty, which is enough to eradicate poverty 26 times over. But really what we are also saying is that this money needs to be seen in the context where 50% of the global people live in poverty. 1 in 4, quarter of the global population, actually sleeps hungry. But I think the real point that we want to underscore is that these billionaires are now not happy being rich and richer. They really want now political power. And they've started buying votes, media houses, political parties, and governments. So at this moment, billionaires are 4,000 times more likely to hold political office than an average citizen. So that's the reality. And what we are seeing is that essentially we are moving away from democracies to oligarchies. So this emergency of inequality is leading to oligarchies. And what we are seeing in the world is a reflection of that.
I wanted to summarize more what's coming out of this stunning report of Oxfam International. You've pointed out the collective wealth of billionaires last year surged by $2.5 trillion, almost equivalent to the total wealth held by the bottom half of humanity, 4.1 billion people. The number of billionaires topping 3,000 last year for the first time, while the richest, Elon Musk, becomes the first ever to surpass $500 billion. The $2.5 trillion rise in billionaires' wealth would be enough to eradicate extreme poverty 26 times over. And U.S. billionaire wealth now stands at $7.935 trillion, more than one-third of all billionaire wealth globally. And the U.S. is home to more billionaires than any other country. And finally, Oxfam reporting highly unequal countries are 7 times more likely to experience the erosion of the rule of law and the undermining of elections. Do you say that we are seeing that in the United States today? And overall, talk about what this means, inequality leading to authoritarianism.
So it's very clear that the billionaires are not happy being rich. And we are seeing how they are actually rigging the economic system, rigging the political system to gain more power. Just let's look at the media. 50% of the global media is owned by these billionaires. 9 out of the 10 biggest social media platforms are again owned by the same billionaires. And 8 of the 10 biggest AI initiatives are again owned by the same billionaires. So what you're seeing is they have enormous power of shaping narratives, of ensuring how politics is going to be run. And it doesn't stop here. They're able to twist policies. We have seen what happened when we saw Trump, a billionaire president, coming in, initially backed by the richest man in the world for many months, with some billionaires sitting in his cabinet. The first big thing they do is to slash taxes for the super rich. So this is the story of how economic policies get twisted. But let's juxtapose this. I've already talked about hunger. I've already talked about poverty. But when you actually see slashing of taxes, and this is not just a phenomenon in the U.S., it's happening globally. On the other hand, you don't have enough resources to invest in basic services like education and health. So what we're seeing is governments are making a massive mistake. They're making a choice of further supporting these billionaires in their accumulation of wealth, in their accumulation of political power, in their capture of state power. On the other hand, as in, let's take the continent Africa, if you combined the debt reservicing that's happening from all the countries there, it's 1.5 times more than the combined budget of education, health, social security. And we all know through research, through experience, that education, health, social security, daycare are the primary drivers of an equal society. So I think it's really important for us to understand that when World Economic Forum says that we're going through a poly crisis, it's not really a poly crisis. It's not a crisis, a climate crisis independent of the hunger crisis and independent of the inequality crisis. These are all one crisis of the economic system we have created with multiple manifestations of it.
In the last minutes we have, you single out the media and you talk about the importance of the media being free to cover inequality. And you also talk about accountability for the political empowerment of ordinary citizens, including stronger protections for people's freedoms of association, assembly and expression. The media can be used to further autocracy or to challenge it. Talk about what you have found and how people overall, everyday people, the vast majority of people in the world can be protected.
Yeah. I think it's really important for us to recognize that when you have economic poverty, it leads to hunger. But when you have political poverty, it leads to anger. And that is what we are seeing across the world. Just last year, we have seen 144 protests, large mass protests by people in more than 60 countries. And that's happening at scale. The anger of common ordinary people against this rigged economic system is spilling onto the streets. When they see that you have a trillion in the making, on the other hand, people are not able to get bread on their table, there is real anger coming around every street. I come from India. So just in South Asia, if you look at countries around me, in the last 2 years, we have seen a change of regime happening first in Sri Lanka because of people's protest, then in Bangladesh because of the students' protest, then in Nepal because of the Gen Z protest. So these protests are really what gives us hope. But let's not forget, the states, instead of supporting the aspirations of common and ordinary people for an equal and just future, they're actually cracking down on protest and repressing protest. And that's translating in dramatic erosion of civil and political rights, dramatic erosion against voices of dissent. So that's really at the moment what we are seeing. But I work with social movements across the globe. I can clearly see that people are rising. And at the moment, because the media is so controlled by these billionaires, we do not get to hear about the anger. And I think the global leadership is making a massive mistake, but by not listening to the real voices of the people. And these voices are going to come together, and they will work towards a just and equal future.
I want to thank you very much, Amitabh Behar, for joining us. You're speaking to us as President Trump has taken the stage at the World Economic Forum, and we'll report on what he says tomorrow. Amitabh Behar is Oxfam International Executive Director, joining us from Davos, Switzerland, from this World Economic Forum, WEF, and we'll link to Oxfam's new report titled Resisting the Rule of the Rich, Protecting Freedom from Billionaire Power. Next up, we hear from New York Mayor Zohran Mamdani and Senator Bernie Sanders on the picket line of the largest nurses' strike in New York history. And we'll speak with a striking nurse who's a lead organizer with their union. Stay with us.
Glory, glory, hallelujah, since I lay my burdens down. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Since I lay my burdens down, every round goes high and higher. Since I lay my burdens down, every round goes high and higher. Since I lay my burdens down.
Glory, glory, hallelujah, performed by Rising Stars Fife and Drum Band at the Brooklyn Folk Festival. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show back here in New York City, where Mayor Zohran Mamdani and Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders joined striking nurses in freezing temperatures Tuesday as the action entered a second week. Nearly 15,000 nurses are engaged in the largest nursing strike in New York history, demanding higher wages, fully funded benefits, an increase in staff to manage patients, and better workplace protections for hospital workers who face violence on the job. Nurses have accused six private New York hospitals, including Mount Sinai, of refusing to negotiate a fair contract. This is Senator Sanders speaking from the picket line.
The people of this country are sick and tired of the greed in the healthcare industry. They're tired of the drug companies ripping us off, the insurance companies ripping us off, and hospital executives getting huge salaries. Don't tell me you can't provide a good nurse-staff ratio when you're paying your CEO at New York Presbyterian $26 million a year. The CEO of Montefiore, $16 million a year. Mount Sinai, $5 million a year. Don't tell me you can't treat nurses with dignity when you're spending hundreds of millions of dollars on traveling nurses. So the people of New York City, the people of Vermont, the people of America love and appreciate our nurses. And today we say to those hospitals, sit down and negotiate a decent contract. Thank you very much.
Joining Senator Sanders in the sub-freezing weather there on the picket line was fellow Democratic Socialist New York City Mayor Zohran Mamdani.
So as Bernie said, it's not about the money.
No!
If it was, we would be talking about compensation packages. We'd be talking about the amount of money spent on travel nurses. What this is in fact about is recognizing the worth of each and every nurse in this city. And so I am here to say the same thing that I said on the first day of this strike, which is that we are encouraging everyone to return to that bargaining table. Too often, when we see a strike, people forget that that is not where workers want to be.
No!
A strike is an act of last resort.
Yes!
What workers want is to be back at work.
Yes!
So what this will mean is making that possible.
Yes!
And so we call on every side to come back to that negotiating table.
Yes!
Have a swift and urgent resolution. And to know that no matter what day it is, we will be here, we will be standing with you, and we will be saying the exact same thing. Thank you so much.
In a minute, we'll be joined by a nurse who's a lead organizer of the strike. But first, we hear from nurses on the picket line outside Mount Sinai West Hospital here in Manhattan.
Rodriguez. I'm on the executive committee at NYSNA. I work here at Mount Sinai West, and we're out here striking for healthcare benefits along with workplace violence protections and safe staffing. Healthcare benefits. We will not accept any cuts. These nurses do not deserve cuts to their healthcare. We need to be physically and mentally stable to take care of our patients and healthy, not just stable, but healthy. I can't provide the kind of care I want to my patients if I'm not mentally healthy or physically able to. I work at Mount Sinai West on 14B, It's a medical surgical telemetry unit. We are also a specialty unit where we provide surgeries for gender reassignments. My daily work is very important. I am the ANCC on my unit. I'm a charge nurse. I take on a full patient assignment while helping out the other nurses on the unit. You know, we get many different kinds of patients being a medical surgery telemetry unit and also a concierge unit. So we may have somebody in one room who has COVID, the next room they just had gender reassignment surgery, and the next room somebody is on their deathbed. So we're having to physically take care of patients while emotionally supporting them as well. And then myself, I have to maintain and manage the unit as a nurse while still having a full patient assignment. It is very taxing. It's very hard. I'm doing the best I can, but I'm out here fighting to make it better and easier for everyone. So my son and my husband depend on my health care, and right now we have no health coverage. Personally, I can't afford COBRA right now. So unfortunately, we don't have any coverage. You know, it does make me very worrisome. I'm out here on the strike, and there's a lot of people. You know, I'm scared. I'm scared, but it's worth the sacrifice. If, you know, we're able to come to a fair contract, it'll all be worth it. So.
Marcon. I work at Mount Sinai Morningside. I work there. I worked at Mount Sinai Maine for 25 years and Mount Sinai Morningside for the past 11, 12 years. I work in the child and adolescent psychiatry. I'm currently the head nurse there. They call it the ANCC. I'm a child psychiatry nurse. So most of the time the children are left to us by the parents. So we have to make sure that we give the care to the children the way the parents should. And we give that emotional support that we're supposed to have. I became a nurse because I really want to care for people. In this part, I was still a young child. I like to help others. And I would like to be in the healthcare because I really like to help others and make others feel better.
That was Nella Pineda Marcon and Nicole Rodriguez. Special thanks to Democracy Now!'s Chirina Nandura and Safwat Nazal. As the nurses' strike enters its 10th day, we're joined now by Michelle Gonzalez, nurse at Montefiore Medical Center, executive committee member of their union, the New York State Nurses Association. Thanks so much for being with us, Michelle. Explain the significance of this strike, the largest in, is it New York City, New York State history, of the thousands of nurses that are on the picket line?
Good morning. Hi, Amy. Yes, this is the biggest nursing strike in New York City history. We have 16,000 nurses out on strike. I am one of them. I work at Montefiore Medical Center, and I am a proud NYSNA nurse. I am part of our negotiating committee at Montefiore. We've been at the table since September trying to negotiate a fair contract. On January 2nd, we placed a 10-day strike notice on the table with the employer in hope that we could receive a fair contract for ourselves and for our patients. Our primary ask and our primary priority is and has always been staffing and improving our staffing ratios so that we can deliver safe patient care and securing benefits such as our healthcare benefits and pension.
Can you talk about how the pandemic changed nursing and talk more about how the hospitals are responding? Many people think of hospitals as nonprofits that are struggling.
So I think with regards to the pandemic was something many nurses worked through that was a very difficult time in our lives. We put our own lives on the line to make sure that we were taking care of our patients. We would come home tired, exhausted, and still very proud of the work that we were trying to do with our patients. We were, a lot of the times, unfortunately, some of the last people that our patients saw. And we tried to do that with the most amount of dignity and respect to our patients that we could. And I think now it's sad and disheartening to see how we're treated by our hospitals. We know that 5 or 6 years ago, we were the heroes of New York City. And now we are treated with little to very no respect. This is by major hospital corporations such as Montefiore, Mount Sinai, New York Presbyterian. These hospital corporations have, you know, a surplus of profits, and it can be seen in how well they pay their CEOs. My CEO at Montefiore Medical Center, Dr. Azua, he's currently at a $16.3 million salary. I think with that in mind, this fight for nurses isn't a fight for improved salary. We would like a salary that includes cost of living, wage increases. But this is a fight for our patients. In Montefiore Medical Center, our patients are chronically in an overcrowded emergency room, which presents unsafe conditions for both the patient and the nurse. They're also put in what we call hallway beds, which is a stretcher that's in the hallway that has no access to a real restroom, to a sink to wash their hands. They have to share a sink and restroom with another patient. If that patient colds or has a life-threatening illness in the hallway, we do not have access to life-saving equipment like oxygen and suction, which in an emergency is necessary. And it's especially frustrating because our CEOs in these hospitals can afford to make the investments into these hospitals and to improve the conditions that the patients are in and improve the conditions, therefore, that the workers exist in. Because it's not just nursing. Our nursing attendants, our respiratory therapists throughout the hospital, our doctors are facing the same working conditions when we have overcrowded emergency rooms and hallway patients.
Joe Gonzalez, can you explain what precautions are being taken if ICE were to go into hospitals? Can they? How are you protected?
So one of our other priorities included in this contract is to have ICE officers not be allowed into our facilities. Unfortunately, our hospitals have not bargained in good faith to make sure that safeguards are put in place to protect our patients. In the Bronx, we have a very high population of Black and brown people, and we have a population of immigrants that we are trying to protect and make sure that they feel safe coming into hospitals. And at this point, we've spent a year since the beginning of the Trump administration beginning to start some of these ICE raids and to increase the level of ICE activity. We've spent the last year trying to build power with our brothers and sisters in CIR, the intern residents, the doctors union, and 1199, which is another union that facilitates our other workers in the hospital, to fight the hospital to get those safeguards in place. And we've been unsuccessful, which is why we've brought it into our contract demands. But still to this point.
And Michelle, we only have 30 seconds. The significance of Bernie Sanders and mostly the New York mayor standing on the picket line with you, Zohran Mamdani.
Yes, ma'am. I think the significance is that, you know, we have the support of many different people, but I think the most important support comes from our patients, our community. I really hope our community knows that this fight is as much for us as it is for them. Mm.
I want to thank you very much for being with us. Michelle Gonzalez is a nurse at Montefiore Medical Center and an executive committee member of the New York State Nurses Association, the union representing nurses. We'll continue to follow what happens. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feldstein, Augusta Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Teresena, Nicole Salazar, Sarah Nasser, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamaru Astudio, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Hani Masood, and Safwat Nazal. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. I'll be speaking in Fort Lee after the showing of Steal the Story, Please! On January 29th at the Barrymore Film Center. Go to our website at democracynow.org. The film is showing about Democracy Now! At 7:30, January 29th. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi there. This is Jan Arden. And if you're listening to Something Fabulous, well, you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, Simon Fraser University Radio, streaming on the internet at cjsf.ca.
Communication is everywhere, but what is it? Communication is how you share your thoughts, your opinions, your culture, from what you see on TV to what you post online. But what about the people who are not being seen or heard? AMI is a media company that strives to be a voice for Canadians with disabilities, whether it's through positive portrayal, reflection, and accessible media. AMI believes everyone should be included, and that includes you. AMI is inclusion. Experience AMI at amiplus.ca.